Hi everybody, my husband and I were just having a chat and I decided that I would just start recording because we kind of want to share some of it with you. It's stupidly late, we should be going to bed, but this is kind of what we do. We have the best intentions, we're going to be in bed by midnight, but then we get into some kind of deep, meaningful conversation. There was a trigger for this evening that I'm not going to go into, but we have literally been talking about our children, about how people don't understand them and don't understand us. They undermine their very real difficulties and what we have to put in as parents. And, you know, I don't mean that in an awful way because, you know, have to put in. It's what we do put in. They're our children. We'll do anything for them. But it can be really, really lonely when you feel like you are not really understood and appreciated. But taking myself away from that, what we do understand is that some people are not capable of understanding. Some people don't want to understand, and you can't change that. So while earlier, I'm going to admit, I had a bit of a meltdown. I cried, I spiraled, I had a lot of emotions, and my husband tried to talk me through it initially a little bit bluntly, I think. but the advice he gave me in the end was, you need to stop letting people in and you need to have more confidence in yourself. I mean, this week we've had a lot of appointments and I don't like sharing certain things because I always feel really paranoid that I sound like I'm being really arrogant. And the fact is, I'm the first to admit that I don't get everything right and I struggle with things. But I have, through my teaching career and parenting, I have committed myself to researching, growing, developing, learning. And I constantly am, you know, I'm always researching and trying to learn new things because you just can't physically know it all. And I don't think that it's a good attitude for anyone to really feel they're ever a real expert on anything, because you can't be. That's my personal opinion. This led to us talking about our children, their challenges. Just in summary, we were talking about my eldest child. We had an appointment, essentially, which is to determine whether he qualifies for a certain service, which I'll talk about another time. But when we were discussing him, it was mentioned that normally this service would only support people with learning disabilities, and he is not deemed to be having a learning disability, even though he scores as having one, because he can learn. And the frustration for us is when he was at school, he was consistently getting report cards that were saying he couldn't learn, he was unable, incapable, and was, you know, demonstrating nothing at school. And we have to think about whether it's the environment, whether it's his ADHD, you know, what barriers are there to him learning that might be presenting as a learning disability, or does he actually have a learning disability, or is it a combination? We feel it's a combination. But yeah, we were told that he couldn't learn, he was incapable. And then obviously I've had him at home for the last year and a half, and we have proved that he really can learn. But in order for him to learn, I have had to kind of go around the houses in order to achieve that. I've had to be very, very creative, very out of the box. And nothing has been able to, you know, to have been done in a conventional way, if that makes sense. And we probably do a couple of hours of learning a week, if that. I do it as organically as possible, and I just do it when I feel that it's accessible to him. And I have to use his interests and so many other things that I could go into. But essentially, the frustration for me is, if he had been referred while he was at school, there would have been an immediate acknowledgement of he has a learning disability. I told you before that when we were trying to get support for him at one stage, we were told that he might qualify for a particular specialist school, because we're not expecting him to do any learning, because, you know, he's not going to be able to access phonics or maths, because he wasn't when he was at school. And then I said, actually, he is learning really well, and he has accessed all of these things, and he can read really well now because I've taught him, and he can actually, you know, perform some really difficult calculations in maths because I've taught him. And they were really shocked, because now he doesn't fit anywhere, because he can't go to mainstream due to all of the sensory issues and the attention issues and, you know, his PDA and the complexities he has. But he also doesn't really fit in specialist provision. Because as we've discussed before, although they're quite good at kind of addressing social, emotional and mental health, which is still questionable in some areas how they achieve that, but that's for another discussion, they don't really prioritise the academic side. And I've been told that part of that is because they don't have staff qualified to deliver that, because that isn't actually what their kind of aim is when they are in that setting. So he's one of those children that's kind of falling in between and is displaced, and there's nowhere for him to go, so he's here. But of course, being here is the best place for him in so many ways, but it doesn't give him access to other children. Despite how much I try and find other kids or opportunities, it's just not the same. So there are so many children out there like him who I just feel are invisible and not really kind of receiving the support that they need. Anyway, so as we acknowledged, if he was still at school, it wouldn't have even been questioned. But because he's learning, he's now considered to not have a learning disability. And yet my personal professional opinion as a former teacher is that he has got a learning disability. We are still researching it, and I'm still collating evidence and doing all my assessments and things. But so far, it does look likely that he is dyslexic. And people scoff at that because he can read, but he's reading from memory. He's sight reading. From what I've been looking into, I think this relates to optalexia. I think that's the word. And again, I'm looking into that. We also feel that he has dysgraphia. And there was something else that I've totally forgotten, but that doesn't matter. No. So we do feel that he has learning disabilities that are separate from the other barriers, like his sensory difficulties, because of course they are going to affect how you access learning, because they're going to get in the way. So in our opinion, he has learning disabilities. And what we were discussing is how people seem to frame learning disability as absolutely incapable of doing anything. And maybe I'm wrong, but my understanding of learning disability is there is a barrier to learning, and that can be overcome at differing levels for different people, of course. But just because he's learning doesn't mean he doesn't have a learning disability, especially when you look at what I am putting in to help him overcome those things. And again, I can talk about that more in another podcast or discussion. But then this moved us on to me talking about my classroom experience. And I had a particular child that I always talk about online and to my husband. And this child, you know, I felt so connected with. And he was put in my class, and as I've shared before, completely disrupted it. He was framed to me as being naughty, expelled from three other schools. And I'm not going to lie, I was dreading having him in my class. I wasn't happy about it because I'd just settled them. And then a couple of weeks later, he came and it was chaotic. He'd go out into the playground. He'd just punch other children. He would run around the school, you know. And as far as we were concerned as a school, he was a disruptive student. Until one day he went missing. And I won't tell the whole story because I've shared it before. But we looked everywhere for him, and I just had to try and get into his mindset of where could this child be. The only safe place he knew was my classroom. So I looked everywhere. Couldn't find him. I even looked in cupboards. He was nowhere. And then I found him squeezed into the tiniest space between the bookcase and the radiator. And his eyes looked terrified, and he was breathing heavy. And it was in that moment that I saw beyond the labels, and I saw this little boy who was terrified. And that was such a huge kind of turning point for me. And that was where I then started seeing him differently, trying to support him differently, and researching everything I could. Every behavior he exhibited, I would go to Google and I would type it in, and I would then research anything, you know, that was very new to me. And that's when I first came across autism, sensory processing disorder. And then, you know, as I've shared before, he did later get diagnosed with a lot of these things. But it took somebody like me to see past the labels and to see past this kind of naughty behaviour. And, you know, I was teaching in a time where this wasn't really that known about, and the training was absolutely shocking. So I'm not telling you this to big myself up. It is literally because I feel thankful he came to my class. I feel thankful for what he taught me. And I feel thankful for him as well, because if he hadn't have come across a teacher like me, he'd have carried on in that cycle. Whereas we ended up having a really nice relationship, and he actually found school quite a nice place to be in. And he did start to thrive there and progress and have friends and, you know, so many things I can go into. But then my husband came up with this kind of revelation, I suppose. And I think he's going to share that with you. So are you happy to speak about what you were going to say?
No, it's just how I was trying to equate it to something that was used in a different sector. The whole idea of the five whys, and it's to do with root cause analysis of the actual underlying problem. So at surface level, you might have, say, a child presenting a certain way. So I'm trying to translate it versus the engineering methods. But the idea is you're trying to find out what's actually causing the problem in the first place, you know, in this other sector. And it involves asking yourself a few questions. It's always you're asking why. And apparently the magic number is about 5 times you've got to ask why something is the way it is. Oh, it's because of this, it's because of that, until eventually you get to the heart of the matter. And using that as your way of finding out what's really going on, which lays into the fact that a lot of kids will present a certain way and we're happy to then, at surface level, take that as the truth and then pigeonhole them in and then treat them or try and help them in a way that is not actually beneficial because it's not actually tackling the heart of the problem. So the idea is not, also not all problems have a single root cause. So if one wishes to uncover multiple root causes, the method must be repeated, asking a different sequence of questions each time. I mean, you could equate that to the multiple issues that a child may have with the comorbidity issue. But so that's the idea. So the idea is you start at a certain sequence and go, right, but why is that the case? And then you keep working yourself down. So it's root cause analysis. And then that's how you overcome it, because you actually uncover the truth. Instead of just being at surface level, you go deeper. And then you end up with understanding as well. And when you get to the heart of the issue, it's only then you can actually start the healing process and really helping that kid. So yeah, the 5 whys, start using that. It's a good way of troubleshooting any problem.
I've always been a really big fan of like finding the why, that's what I call it. And I'm not sure where I first ever heard of it. I think I used to refer to it as something completely different just from my own kind of realizations as a teacher, and then obviously then becoming a parent. But then I found somebody who used that terminology and I liked it, you know, find the why. And it to me, I like it because it's more, it just triggers you to look deeper. And, you know, I love all those iceberg pictures they do where you see so much on the surface, but then you have to really think deeper about what's going on underneath and what's causing it and what are the triggers. And
yes,
you know, I love it. In fact, I've just created something recently that I've used an iceberg a diagram in it, because I just think it's such an effective visual. So but yeah, I'm a really, really big believer in that. And I think you can't always deal with things at surface level. And we're having that issue with our son, because like I said, you know, over the years we've taught him a lot of toolkits and scripts, and when he was young they worked for him a lot better than they did as he got older. As he got older, you know, things became so complex for him, the sensory world became a lot more kind of chaotic, and his ADHD is now, you know, kind of gone to a new degree, I suppose. So we do an awful lot of things to help regulate him. So I'd say, you know, he's still supported quite well, as much as we possibly can, but he does have these barriers to learning, and definitely these barriers to the mainstream classroom, and I believe even to the specialist classroom, if I'm honest, from the strategies and things that I'm hearing other parents discuss with me, and some of the things they're using in these schools. And I'm sorry, but some of it is kind of ABA, and whether you're pro or against ABA, some of these strategies are just like the sanctions, quite frankly. I'm not a big believer in the sanctions, and it feels wrong because I had to do them when I was first teaching, but I used to know they didn't really work, and so I kind of loosely had them up in my classroom, but I didn't, you know, because we used to get all of the staff and senior management and stuff going around ticking on sheets if we had it in our classroom. There were things you had to have there, otherwise you would get kind of felled or critiqued. So it was in my classroom, but I just very rarely used it. And if I did ever use it, it would literally be when I was being observed, just to tick a box. But the children were very aware, and I involved them in this whole process. And some people frown upon that, but, you know, I tried to involve them as much as possible so that they knew what was going on and they were empowered. And, you know, some people used to criticize me for that and say, you share too much with those children. But actually, I had such harmonious classrooms. Like, we did have challenging behavior. I had challenging classes, but they felt valued and they felt part of it. And they knew I cared about them as individuals. And to me, I think that's the most important thing. And so therefore, when they did present with any behavior, I didn't at surface level kind of judge them for it. There was always a reason. And especially with the children I taught, you know, they had a lot of different reasons. And some of them had such low self-esteem. And you did get some, like even you, my husband. when he was at school, you moved from school to school. You came to my school quite late when I met you in our secondary. And you kind of created a persona, I suppose. You became the class clown. You misbehaved, and a lot of teachers would have looked at you at surface level and thought, oh yeah, he's just playing up, he's just a difficult child, he's just showing off. And what they didn't see really was that this was a child who'd been moved into our school, was completely displaced. I think you came in during exam week, so you couldn't actually be placed in sets to your ability, if that makes sense. So you were stuck in all the lower ones, which is absolutely fine, but it's not where you personally belonged. And, you know, with that, you just had absolutely no enthusiasm to be there. You didn't enjoy being in that space, and so therefore that affected your behavior. You were like, fine, you're going to treat me like this, then I'm just not going to bother. And being a PDA as well, I can kind of, now we know that about you, you can understand it even more so. But you know, there weren't many teachers who looked for the why, but you had one teacher who was your tutor, and he did look for the why, and he saw you, and he saw what a good person you were. And I think I shared this in another podcast, but my mum and dad used to go to parents' evenings, and they knew that my husband, obviously at the time, was my friend, but they knew we were very close. And just, I think, a few weeks ago, my mum was telling me that they used to always talk to my parents about him, and like how proud they were of him and how well he was doing at school. And they knew what a hard life he had, and they knew how tough things were for him, and you know, what the triggers were to some of his behaviour. And I shared that with you. And how did that make you feel?
Yeah, I just can't really articulate it, to be honest.
I think you were quite emotional, yeah. You know, that because the perception you had of yourself, the image you had of yourself was not a great one, was it?
No.
And up until adulthood, that's been the same image you've had of yourself.
Yeah, it tends to follow you into adulthood.
And I think this is why it's so important to us, like with our child and with, you know, kind of spreading this message out there, is we don't want these children growing up to feel like that, to feel inadequate and to have low self-esteem and confidence. And we think now, if I had not intervened with my son and taught him, he would have probably been, it would have probably been encouraged that he go into the setting they discussed for him. And quite frankly, his behaviour would have probably deteriorated there because he would have been bored. He's not necessarily somebody who can articulate how he's thinking or feeling. So the behaviour would have been his message. And I am sure he would have been punished accordingly or restrained, which I know does happen in some places, even though it's not supposed to. But if they see somebody as being a danger, then that's what they do. And, you know, and also I just think, use the word rot, and I think there is an element of that. He would have rotted in there, and he'd have just been wasted, because he's proved already that he's very capable, but you just have to have the patience and the creativity to find a way in.
He's always, you know, with the ADHD side, he's chasing dopamine hits.
Yeah, totally.
He wants constant stimulation. I can't blame him. I like stimulation too.
Yeah. But, you know, it sounds so negative what I'm saying. And, you know, I know there's a place for all children and that kind of, and some children do benefit from different settings. And, you know, so I'm not saying that one is good or bad. I'm just saying they're not always a good fit for every individual. But sadly, yes, you get put into a box when you're autistic. And because I've got two children who are autistic, and to put it really bluntly, my youngest is probably no more intelligent than my eldest, I wouldn't say, but he can access things a lot more easily, and he isn't as distracted with his ADHD. He isn't as distracted by the sensory environment, so therefore he presents a little bit more, I don't know how to say it really without sounding awful. he presents, I suppose, as a child who is easier to teach, who's more interested, more engaged. And teachers have got a bit more time for that kind of child. They can see the ability. It's really obvious to them.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the best way to explain it. Whereas our eldest, it is not apparent in the way he speaks to you, in the way he interacts with you, in the way that he engages during lessons or any activity. He does not present as somebody who is able to undertake things that actually I've kind of proved he can. But again, I've had to do so much to get him there. So we've got the binary with him where he's either, we're told, oh, no, no, he's absolutely incapable, or, oh, now he can learn. He's not, he doesn't have a learning disability, and actually he does. So it's a really tricky one. And there are so many children like him that I wonder, you know, what's happened to children like him? Are they at home like he is because there's nowhere for them? Or have they been put into the wrong setting? And what has that caused? Because your issue, isn't it, and just I'm just pointing at my husband, is that you feel a lot of children are put into the specialist places. And of course, there is no academic focus. There is in some schools, but then you find they're the ones that then have more of the sanctions in place and that kind of thing, which does not work for PDAs at all. You know, and you seem to feel that they then come out with nothing. And it's kind of, you call it a glorified creche.
Yeah, I'm not going to be around the bush. The worst thing in the world is wasted potential and not being able to fulfill your potential.
But I think they have so much value to add, so it's not a criticism, and I appreciate that's how it might come across. I think what our point is, though, is how many children are in those settings where they feel their needs are being met, but actually they had potential beyond what they've been given the opportunity to fulfil.
Because, again, at surface level, they present a certain way, but
yeah.
There's...
No one looks deeper.
The abilities, the intelligence are more nuanced. You have to peel more layers back and ask more why.
And I think the opportunity should be there. And I actually know people who have had children go through specialist school, and they've actually begged the school, please at least help them get their core subjects because they're able academically. Mm-hmm. But there just hasn't been the opportunity, I suppose, from having the correct staff in school. And yet again, you get some, and I am going to say it, some staff that work in these schools are a little bit ableist,
mm-hmm.
and they're also a bit out of date. And I hate to say it, but I've come across so many people who've worked with autistic individuals, children, young people, and they really, they do talk about autistic people like they're inferior. And we're spoken about as though we're all these young, stupid children. And I say this really cautiously because, of course, there are some autistic people who do have intellectual disabilities and they are going to struggle in certain areas. So I'm not taking that away from anybody or painting it as a bad thing. But they put us all in the same box and it really is a spectrum. We're not all the same and it should be individualised. And I don't feel there's enough of that going on. And I think our son really does kind of illustrate the problem that we currently have. He cannot go to mainstream, but specialist is also just absolutely not right for him. And we've talked about maybe down the line split provision just so he can be around other children who are similar to him behaviourally. But they can't offer academic support. So therefore, I would be still taking responsibility for that on the days he's not in the setting. But this is a long way off.
Everything's too binary. It's you either one camp or the other. And it's not, it doesn't consider the individual. It never does. And this is the trouble with these institutions and these systems. They debase you to that is literally you are.
Yeah, you fit in this box, so therefore you go to this setting. You fit in this box, you go to this setting.
That's it, and it doesn't matter if you don't really fit neatly into either. You have to pick one.
Yeah, it is that.
And choose none of the above.
We do understand that trying to create spaces like this is also very complex. So I'm not trying to say it's not. It's a problem that's easily solved, because if it was, it would be solved, wouldn't it?
This problem isn't going away, and I believe that the numbers will only increase.
Yeah, and also I think at the moment, being specific about our PDAs, you know, there are a lot of very intelligent PDAs out there who, as much as many like to be self-led and like to kind of lead their own learning, there is still a place for facilitation to help them in that journey, but that isn't really accessible either at the moment, and I think it's a real shame, and we're kind of letting down so many kids, and it's just awful.
In a way, it's, you almost need to have it so it's the institutions providing a framework for the PDA to explore in a safe way, where it's kind of, it's not like a completely open world, but it appears a certain way, and you know what I mean? So you feel like there's room to explore around the subject
or yeah.
the environment.
You know, and it's even just saying that, you know, there are certain things that we need to teach you or that you need to learn, and being very clear as to why. But saying, you know, we're going to give you some independence and we're going to give you some choice over how you go about learning that.
Which is how I operate.
You know, digital, maybe you still have lessons accessible, but they don't have to go to the formal lesson. They can go to the digital one if they would rather. You know, and again, you don't necessarily have to go into a school building. It's just, but I think there should still be some kind of support available to those children.
Well, this is the thing, you know, PDAs crave autonomy and sovereignty over their own life. And it's like me and my job, like I said, I keep using that as an example, but the reason why I'm enjoying my role at the moment is because it's a case of, here you go, here's some objectives that we need to meet. Don't care how you do them.
Just get there.
Can you meet the objective? And I'm like, yeah, I can. Can I do it on my terms, please? Excellent. You allow me to operate in the best way, the way I'd like to do the task and the methods and all that. That's completely down to me. Brilliant. Bang. And that's how success happens.
Yeah. See, I would admit, like, the teaching model, like a typical lesson, you kind of have a bit of a warm-up and then you have your input. And that is where you will introduce and model a task. And then you send them off to go and do something independently. And then you come back and you reflect on it. You have a plenary. And I think that that model's absolutely fine. But, you know, even just small adaptations to that can help. So just differentiation, really. But the model is brilliant for all children. But, you know, some children need to have that ability to go, well, actually, I don't want to do it that way. I want to do it this way. I know there are some tasks that you can't. I mean, I used to be really honest with the kids and say, there, I will try and make it as interesting as possible. I know this is repeated as well. But there are some lessons that are going to be a bit dry because there's things I need to teach you that unless I kind of do it this way, there isn't really another way to kind of make it entertaining. But what we can do is maybe play around with it once we know the basics, you know, so you still give them that, okay, it's going to be worth listening because it's we're going to be doing something fun with it, or make it into a game, or, you know, you can't make everything a song and a dance, sadly. You just can't. But you also need to appreciate that there are some children who that's not going to be right for, so you need to find different ways in. But I think you definitely need to give that kind of independence and that choice. And say, for example, if you're doing an experiment or a project or something, then the children who need that scaffold can use that scaffold. But those children that kind of want to go off and use their own ideas should have the freedom to do so. And very often in a classroom environment, you're not encouraged to do that. You're told, no, they need to just mimic what you've done and just prove they can get it and, you know, mark it in a book because it's all for Ofsted. And actually, this is where I think the problem lies. I think the focus is on the wrong thing. It should really be about the child's confidence, their enjoyment, their progress.
Isn't that the whole point?
Their self-esteem. Education. Yeah, absolutely. But it isn't. It's about, let's get something in a book so that we have evidence. And, you know, sometimes the best learning isn't book-based, but I could go off on a rant about that, so I'm going to stop there. But just to end with the few positives we had this week, I won't go into details, but we've had a few appointments and we've, I think, seen several different professionals, and I've had really lovely feedback from several of them. And, you know, it's been quite an emotive week. Not only has our eldest now been formally recognised on the NHS as being autistic with PDA profile, so for those practitioners that say, oh no, sorry, it's not real, does not exist, we won't diagnose it, you know, people are diagnosing it, so there you go. So fight it all the way is what I'm going to say. Also ADHD, sensory processing disorder, and Tourette's. And that was awesome. But what was really great is I challenged a medical professional and they really respected actually what I had to say. And that was a bit of a shocker. I thought it was going to make things awkward and it didn't. And then several times over the last kind of couple of months, I've had actual health professionals, you know, very experienced, reputable people compliment me on my knowledge and what I've actually learned and what I've put into place for my children. And that's been very validating, and I'm so proud of myself. But I'm wary to say that to people because people try and take it away from you, like you're being arrogant, or they like to put you in your place that you're nothing special. And, you know, I've never claimed I am, but I can say that, you know, I have spent years now fighting for my children, and people don't understand that unless they live it. But I have tried to learn the heck out of everything to benefit my children, and so that I am armed with knowledge. And but I do worry about those families who haven't got that for whatever reason, and not necessarily because they're not capable. They might not have the time available to do it. And, you know, but I will admit I've not slept for a long time. And I think a lot of it comes down to the stress of this existence, to be honest, and constantly having to be an expert in everything and prove yourself. But for our family, I feel like things are actually kind of on the up. I don't want to jinx it, but I do. I feel like things are becoming more positive. We're being recognised as parents. The children are being recognised. I feel like we're in a much better place than we've ever been from a professional perspective, but we're still having issues from the personal side of things. And I'm really sad to say, it's from family and friends who don't get it, and it hurts that they don't go and do the research. It hurts they don't listen to us. And then they kind of reflect things back at you that just prove they don't understand. And I'm finding that really hard to deal with. But, you know, you can't make people understand. It's a really tricky, tricky thing. So, but yeah, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll speak soon.